From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Steve Martin talks with us about comedy, acting, and writing plays. His book of plays is about to be published. Also, we'll hear from comedian-turned-actor Robert Wall. He stars in the new HBO comedy Arliss, about a sports super agent. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. I take all my money and bought me a museum. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton says he signed orders to send U.S. troops to Kuwait to help contain the military movements of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton said that despite newspaper reports of a delay in deploying troops, he authorized the deployment last week and signed the orders last night. This morning, President Clinton briefed congressional leaders on the situation in Iraq, and although the meeting did not satisfy Republican critics, the president said he is still convinced the military response to Iraq was just right.
What we did was appropriate. What we did by extending the no-fly zone is to say, we want you to understand we have no intention of permitting you to threaten your neighbors. We are going to limit your ability to maneuver. The box you are in is now a tighter box.
Republican senators say the administration cost the U.S. credibility by hinting at a disproportionate response to Iraq and then backing away. But the president insists his actions and his rhetoric have been very closely calibrated. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
It's taking a long time to count ballots in Bosnia's first post-war election. But some initial returns suggest an overwhelming victory for Bosnia's ruling nationalist leader of the country's three ethnic groups. NPR's Silvio Pujoli reports.
Returns from almost a third of the counting centers in each of Bosnia's two entities, the Muslim Croat Federation and the Bosnian Serb Republic, show a neck-and-neck race between the Muslim leader and current president, Alija Izetbegović, and the Bosnian Serb nationalist hardliner, Momcilo Krajnic, for the top post in the three-member presidency. The presidency is to be formed by one Muslim, one Croat, and one Serb, and the one who wins most votes overall will be first among equals. Meanwhile, an internationally supervised special appeals subcommission has received about 60 complaints on election day irregularities. The majority concern the large numbers of voters who did not find their names on voter registration lists and were unable to vote. This is Silvia Poggioli in Sarajevo.
The Bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates does not want to include Reform Party candidate Ross Perot in any presidential debates. The news has been hailed by Bob Dole's campaign staff. The Republican challenger has sought to limit the presidential debates to one-on-one confrontations with Bill Clinton. A study has been presented to the National Transportation Safety Board that finds passenger side airbags may save adult lives, but they are deadly for children. It says 12 children have died so far this year because of them. The NTSB study also details problems with child safety seats. In many cases, safety seats are not being used properly. The Washington Post reports the Safety Board is expected to use the report to recommend that automakers find a way to slow down the inflation of passenger-side airbags, making them more safe for children. On Wall Street, the Dow is up. This is NPR News. California will become the first state in the nation to chemically castrate repeat child molesters when the state's governor signs a new bill into law today. Rachel Gottbaum of member station KQED reports from San Francisco.
Under the bill, twice convicted child molesters will receive injections of the drug Depo-Provera before they leave prison and for some time afterward. Supporters of so-called chemical castration say the controversial practice will stop child molesters from striking again. But many medical experts say chemical castration is an ineffective way to prevent sex offenses, and many call it a cruel form of punishment. Despite those criticisms, California Governor Pete Wilson supports the measure. The law, which goes into effect on January 1st, is expected to face several challenges in the courts. Texas, Massachusetts, and Wisconsin are all considering similar measures. For National Public Radio, I'm Rachel Gottbaum in San Francisco.
Heavy rain and strong winds in southeastern North Carolina have caused more damage in areas trying to recover from Hurricane Fran. At least three people have been hurt. The National Weather Service confirms one tornado struck the city of Kinston overnight, damaging the city's public works complex and destroying a farm building. Meanwhile, residents of upstate South Carolina are checking damage after tornadoes rushed through three counties overnight. Thousands of people lost power, but no major injuries were reported. A spokesman for the U.S. Embassy in Kenya says an American has been kidnapped in Somalia. He was working for the U.S. Agency for International Development. The man was taken in North Mogadishu, but little else is known about his capture. Kidnappings and extortion, especially of foreigners attached to foreign aid agencies, are common in Mogadishu. The last USAID worker kidnapped in Somalia was a woman who was held for 2 days last March. She was freed unharmed. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. Great to be here for the closing night show here at what is this? Is this San Francisco? Okay, been here for 2 weeks, and this is the closing night. We'll do two shows tonight. And I'm really looking forward to it. So so let's get going, huh? I mean, I have had a lot of fun since I've been here. I do like coming to San Francisco because it is an intellectual town. And that's kind of what I'm into. I dig the intellectual kind of thing. And I had a good time since I've been here. I know that sounds phony, because every entertainer in the world comes out, no matter where they are, they go, "Hey, it's really great to be here!" And it really sounds fake, but I am sincere when I say, "Hey, it's really great to be here!"
Steve Martin from his first recording, Let's Get Small. Today we're going to talk with him about how he got started in comedy, acting, and writing plays. Steve Martin is, of course, best known for his stand-up comedy, his frequent appearances on Saturday Night Live, and his films, which include The Jerk, Roxanne, Pennies from Heaven, All of Me, Parenthood, and Father of the Bride. He wrote the screenplays for The Jerk and Roxanne. He also writes for the stage, and now he has a new book of his plays called Picasso at the Le Pan Agile. The title play premiered at Chicago's Steppenwolf Theater and moved to Los Angeles, where it was the longest-running show in the history of the Westwood Playhouse. I asked Steve Martin how he started writing plays.
Yeah, I had written a lot of... I'd written screenplays my whole life, and before that I'd written for television, and I had done stand-up comedy, and I knew that in writing screenplays, you write the thing, shoot it, and then see if it's any good. And something appealed to me about the process of writing a play in which you can write it, try it out, and then rewrite it and edit it, and that it was going to be done live. So I felt that these were two good areas for me because I like to work on my feet, and I can sort of have a good ear for fixing things when I hear it, and especially in front of an audience. And I thought it was appropriate for me. And when I started writing plays, I realized that something different was coming out than I'd ever written before, and I liked that too.
No, I was going to point that out. Your play seemed to really be influenced by absurdist drama.
Well, I suppose so. I don't know. You know, influence is so strange because sometimes you hate to admit it. And you know, other times you're proud. You know, it's very obvious where certain things came from. So... But I'm not really up on absurdist drama, so I think the plays can be absurd. They're kind of surreal more than absurd, I think, now that we've defined that.
Right. the title play in your new collection, Picasso at the Le Pan Agile, brings together Picasso and Einstein in 1904. Why did you want to do that?
I was very interested in Picasso my whole life, and I would read about him and art too, and I would read about it and think about it, and I realized I had something to say about it, and I started writing this play, and certain things started happening as I was writing because I had nothing to lose, really. I could just write freely because this was such you know, it was out of the world of what I do, so I really had nothing to lose. I didn't even know if I'd ever put it on. So I just let whatever came out come out. And I, all these characters started coming in, and I started typing, and Einstein came in the door. And there he was. And so I had to deal with him, and I later realized that they both represented the two worlds that I wanted to merge, science and art.
So do you ever act in your own plays?
No, I haven't, and probably won't. I really wanted to, for example, this first play, I really wanted to work without a celebrity in it. I wanted to be able to watch the actors and not think that something was getting a laugh because it was me. I wanted to see that the character was working. And also it's a lot easier just to sit back and watch it and write and think about it and listen to the audience.
I'd like to hear a little bit about you biographically. I know when you were young, your family moved a couple of miles away from Anaheim, where
right.
Disneyland soon located. How old were you when Disneyland opened?
10. And it's so funny. I just got a Diane Arbus photograph of the Magic Castle at Disneyland that was taken in 1955. And I used to stand in front of this little spot in front of the Magic Castle and sell the Disneyland news when I was 10. And there's the swans in the moat and the swans I seem to remember. You know, I knew those particular swans. And there was something perfect in the merging of Diane Arbus and this, fantasy family place. And she brought out the kind of surrealism of it, and it was a perfect image for me. So I wake up to it every day.
that's great. Now, how did you gravitate to Disneyland? I mean, I'm not sure how much meaning Disney had for you at the time. You were maybe too old for the Mickey Mouse Club, and I don't know if Mickey Mouse, the cartoon character, meant anything.
I liked the idea of dressing up in gay 90s clothes and working at Disneyland.
That was the uniform, so to speak, that you wore to sell the Disney news?
Yeah, sell the Disneyland news. And then I did all kinds of things. That's where I really got my start in show business, because when I was about 15, I got a job in a magic shop there demonstrating card tricks. And I got to stand up in front of people and make them laugh, and it was very interesting. And then I moved over to Knott's Berry Farm, where they did a melodrama theater. And I performed in that for about 3 years while I was going to college.
So you learned...
And then I did this interview.
The rest is history.
Yeah.
I read that you met a vaudevillian in Disneyland also, who influenced you. Who was that?
His name was Wally Bogue, and he worked at the Pepsi Golden Horseshoe Review, it's called. And he was a very funny guy. And he did balloon animals, but he had a great sense of humor, and it was very clean, and it was crisp. And I used to watch the show endlessly, hoping, of course, that he would get sick, and they would say, is there an 11-year-old who could possibly fill in for Wally?
You know, it's interesting as an 11-year-old that you related to this vaudevillian kind of act because it was from another era.
Well, this would have been about 1956, 57. So the era wasn't so far gone.
Right, these guys were still on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Who?
Guys like that were still on the Ed Sullivan Show on
sure,
TV
absolutely.
All the time.
Yeah, it didn't matter the style of performing. It was just the idea of being funny and getting up there at that point. When you're 11, you're not thinking about style. You're thinking about stealing.
Were there things that he was doing that you really imagined yourself doing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know what you mean. He would tell jokes and do balloons.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, which you did. Yeah. Steve Martin is my guest, and he has a new book of his plays called Picasso at the Le Panagio. You went to college and majored in philosophy, dropped out after 3 years. Let's start with a philosophy.
Well, actually, it was 4 years.
But 4 years.
I changed my major when I was a senior.
Uh-huh.
And
changed it to or from philosophy?
From philosophy to theater.
Oh.
And then I got a job writing for the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and I quit.
Why did you major in philosophy?
I met a girl when I was 18, and we fell in love in that sort of 18-year-old way. And she was very enthusiastic about knowledge and learning, and she made me read The Razor's Edge, and I got all excited about studying philosophy, and I'm glad I did.
I wonder if you think philosophy has helped you with writing comedy at all? I mean, if you've ever, because I think you have kind of applied some of the, you know, logic of philosophy toward toward humor in
yeah,
making fun
true.
Of it or deconstructing it.
Yeah, I think it has helped me quite a bit. And just, I can't tell you why, but I feel it's still being used. And yet, if you ask me, you know, to give the philosophy of Hegel, I would have a hard time remembering. But certain, it's just gave me concepts that I've used my whole life.
Can you think of a particular sketch or something you used to do in your stand-up act that you felt really had a direct connection to what you read?
Not really, but I did understand that that you know absurdism came into my act quite a bit. So I think that somehow that was linked to philosophy because it was always denying the truth or making leaps to things that weren't logical or it's so you know it's hard to remember all these things and if I did it wouldn't be that interesting you know to say well, yes this was based on Aristotle's you know
that's right
because they're just based on trying to make people laugh and that's what came out.
But I am into the intellectual thing. I went to college. I studied the great philosophers, Socrates. I studied Plato. And you know, you learn the important things. Like, if you're studying geology, which is all facts, as soon as you get out of school, you forget it all, you know? Because it's just numbers and things. But philosophy, you remember just enough to screw you up for the rest of your life. You know? And you study the important, like, ethical questions. Is it okay to yell movie in a crowded firehouse? Religious questions. Does the Pope shit in the woods? And keep waiting sometime, you know. Oh. If there is a God, give me a sign. See, I told you that the.
We'll talk more with Steve Martin after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Steve Martin, he has a new book of his plays called Picasso at the Le Pen Agile. Now, when you started writing for the Smothers Brothers, were you already doing stand-up yourself?
Yes, I was. I was doing stand-up, and this is another, my whole life is sectioned off into girlfriends, really, because I was dating a girl who was a dancer on the Smothers Brothers show, and we kind of broke up, and then she started dating the head writer. And at the time, this would be about 1967, it was very, very hip to be under 30. So they said, we want all writers under 30. So there I was. I was 21 years old, and I submitted some things I'd written, and they hired me. And actually, Mason Williams was the head writer, and he was, I found out later, was very generous and hired me and paid me out of his own pocket.
Wow.
For the first summer that I worked there, and then I was hired on.
What was your stand-up comedy like back in your early 20s?
It was essentially what I did in the late 70s. It was, you know, it had all that same shape, and it was. But I used to read poems. You know, I used to actually play the banjo seriously, and it was a little bit of everything. It was the kitchen sink idea, and then I started to. Have a better understanding of what I was doing, and I made some decisions about what I was going to do, and that shaped it even further in the 70s before it just sort of broke out.
What kinds of decisions?
Well, you know, we were just coming out of the war era, and everyone had really long hair and was very, very serious. And I decided that it was time for something ridiculous. And I cut my hair, and I was determined to be the first person to cut their hair. And I put on a suit and went out on stage and started being really, really stupid. And it was just the right time to do that because everyone was so earnest and smart and philosophical and hating everyone. And it was just the right time for someone to be happy.
So it took the philosophy major to figure this out, be stupid on stage.
I don't know. Yeah, right.
Were you ever uncomfortable off stage with your short haircut when everybody else had their hair long?
No. No, it wasn't. And when I say short, it was relatively short.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was, I mean, look at pictures today and think, gee, my hair was really, really long. But that was the, you know, philosophy then.
So many comics approach their comedy from an ethnic perspective. There's a long history of, you know, the Jewish comic or, you know, the Jewish dialect comic or, you know, African-American comics talking about coming of age as an African-American in predominantly white America and so on. Did you ever wish that you had like an ethnic slant that you could use in your comedy? Or were you not ever interested in heading in that direction?
No, not at all. My comedy was much more mental. And I didn't... it was strange because it was physical and mental at the same time. It was almost conceptual sometimes. So that wouldn't have done me any good. And that comedy exists in the real world, and my comedy didn't.
That's interesting. What do you mean by that, about it not existing in the real world?
Well, it doesn't. I always thought of my comedy character, such as it was, as a person who was totally isolated and who had to, in a sense, redefine the world in order to get by, couldn't be influenced by the outside. He had to deeply believe in every dumb thought that he had. So that's the most sophisticated it's ever gotten. I mean, just saying it to you now, because I never thought about it that much, but kind of looking back. So it wasn't about a person in this world. It was strange. It was about a nutcase in this world. So... yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm wondering, when you started doing your more physical comedy and the arrow through the head thing and acting kind of like, you know, goofy and ridiculous on stage, was it hard for you to become that persona? I'm wondering if you were, you know, more inhibited off stage, if that kind of physical approach to comedy came natural to you.
Yeah, it came very natural on stage, and it was developed, you know, through a series of performances, and I had the luxury of working all over the country with essentially no one watching. So you could just try things out and it didn't matter. And I remember reading an interview with Bill Cosby once, and he said the audience wasn't laughing. He said, but I knew something was happening because the waitresses were. And they saw it night after night after night after night. And in a way, you start playing to insiders. And then they tell people. And then pretty soon you have an audience of insiders, which is exactly what you want.
Now, did you have a sturdy enough ego to withstand any rejection you got early on or indifference?
Oh, I was... I don't know how to answer that because it always hurts. I had some terrible, terrible reviews. I mean, to this day, I can't forgive the writer for saying such horrible things. But, that doesn't really go away. You get very philosophical about it. And actually, it kind of does go away after a while. You just go, well, life goes on and this too shall pass.
How did you start doing the balloon animals in your act? You said you'd seen some of this in Disneyland by that vaudevillian.
Well, you know, there was a tradition of, you know, magic acts that don't work.
Uh-huh.
And I realized early on I wanted to do that. And then I thought, well, balloon animals, and I'll have balloon animals that don't work. So that's where it came from. It's pretty simple.
And what about putting the fake arrow through your head?
I don't know. There's something so incredibly stupid about it. And, you know, it was a moment, you know. And, you know, it's not a major event. It was just part of the act.
And did the excuse me thing originate in your early stand-up years?
Yes. Yeah. That evolved when I was working in the boarding house and You know, it's just night after night, and pretty soon you just fly off the handle. And you start saying things, and you start last night I said this, and I want to write that down. And then you try it again the next night, and you go a little bit further and a little bit further, and pretty soon you're there.
Do you remember the first time you used it?
I think I was at the boarding house, and I had a whole bit where I would pretend to be an arrogant entertainer and get really mad at the spotlight operator. And I would just go on this, I would just go crazy and end the routine with that, crazy with anger at the spotlight operator.
I think it was after the Smothers Brothers when you were doing stand-up and you were better known at this point. You did a lot for opening for rock groups.
Yeah.
In concert arenas, was it? Was it
that I did all that. It was terrifying because, I mean, Albert Brooks has a great bit where he says he opened for Ritchie Valens once and he was backstage and he hears the audience going, Ritchie, Ritchie, Ritchie. And he starts to go on to open the show and there's a guy backstage who is going to open the curtain. He looks at Albert and says, you better be Ritchie.
So they weren't
exactly
necessarily happy
like
to see you.
No. But I learned quickly that you don't do that.
You don't do what?
You don't open for big rock bands with a small comedy act.
So where did you go?
I went to small clubs. And I places that seated 99 people. And I called David Brenner, who was very hot at the time. And I said, David, how do you make any money in this world? I mean, I'd get paid, you know, $300 a night, and it would cost me $450 to get there and back. And he said he would lease out a club, and he would take the money at the door. And so I said, well, that's what I'll do. So I started going to little clubs and headlining rather than opening, because I understood the audience, no matter how good you did as an opener, they didn't care. They only cared about the headliner. So I decided to play to smaller houses and be a headliner than open the show for larger houses.
Steve Martin, he has a new book of his plays called Picasso at the Le Panagil. We'll talk more in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Well, anyway, I guess you can tell that I'm into language, and language is kind of my thing, being a comedian. And if you don't have a command of the language, nothing to be embarrassed about, but because this is my profession. And let's face it, some people have a way with words, other people... not have way, I guess.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our conversation with Steve Martin, also comic and actor Robert Wall, on his new HBO series Arliss, about an ethically challenged sports agent. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Back with comic, actor, and writer Steve Martin. He has a new book of his plays called Picasso at the Le Panagile. Here's more from his first album.
I went over there thinking, you know, oh, everyone's going to speak English, no problem. I don't speak a word of French. It's a universal language, so I'll just be able to speak English. So I get off the plane, I get into a taxi. The first indication I'm going to have trouble, I say to the driver, like to go to a hotel, please. The driver turns and goes, je te suis la douleur de soi. What? What is that you're saying? So the first thing you do, this is really dumb. You think this will help. You adopt a French accent. I would like to go to the hotel. So that's nothing. So I went out, I bought a little French phrase book, hoping to memorize little phrases, you know, how do you, can I go to the bathroom and things like that. But French is not like Spanish. In Spanish, you can sound it out. It's easy for Americans. You know, every vowel is a syllable. You go, Casa de Pepe. Donde está Casa de Pepe? But French is like, Je ne le dois. Le dois. What happened? What happened? He spoke French! Help him!
Did you ever think that you were going to outgrow some of your comedy, that it would be unseemly after a certain age to do some of the physical comedy that you were doing?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a, you know, it's a, comedy is like, it's an agreement between yourself and the audience that you are funny. And,
right.
And you, you know, that you can get very, very hot, and then that agreement can, it can go away. It can move on. It moves on to other places. You know, right now Jim Carrey's got it. And he is actually really, really funny. But when that magic agreement is kind of severed through time and you say, okay, well, now what are you going to do next? You have to actually be funny. You know, you have to really, really work. And you have to find it some other way than just the newness and excitement of it.
One of my favorites of your films is Pennies from Heaven, mm-hmm. which is a film that unfortunately I think a lot of people did not get to see. It didn't do that well at the box office. It's a wonderful film. It's set in the Depression era. You're a sheet music salesman who's not mm-hmm. selling a lot of sheet music, and but you love those pop songs and. All the sentiments they express about true mm-hmm. love and mm-hmm. pleasure in life, the magic of living. And your inner life is expressed through those songs. And when you want to, like, say something, you imagine the song and then you start lip-syncing to an old,
right.
to an old record.
Right.
Tell me how your interest in this movie and in taking the role.
Well, I had seen, I have a friend, actually, Victoria Daly, who's publishes, she's a publisher. In fact, she published just recently a limited edition of one of my plays, Wasp, mm-hmm. that was that's illustrated by Martin Mull. And we actually just published those ourselves. And then I do sort of the bigger version, which I did with Grove, of the plays that you may have in your hand now. I don't know. And she called me up one day about 1979 or 80 and said, you've got to watch this thing on television called Pennies from Heaven. So I started watching it, and it's the BBC did a six-hour version of the Dennis Potter script, Pennies from Heaven. And so a couple of years later, I got a call from my agent, and he said, there's a script here called Pennies from Heaven. They're going to make a movie out of it. And I said, is it the BBC? And he said, I don't think so. I think it's based on the old Bing Crosby movie. I said, I said, do we sing in it? He goes, yeah, you lip sync or something. I said, send it. And it was the perfect antidote for me at the time, because I'd just done The Jerk and I didn't want to do Jerk 2, and I thought, what am I going to do next? I'm tired, I'm exhausted. And this thing came along, and I loved it. I would do it again. You know, I had to learn to tap dance in 4 months.
Oh, you learned for the movie?
Yeah, I didn't know how to tap dance at all.
Huh. What was that experience like?
It was very hard. It was yeah, I really worked hard. It was those days, you know, when you just decide you're going to do something.
How was your sense of rhythm?
It was pretty good. You know, I played the banjo, so I had a musical
right.
sense.
Right. And we should mention that Pennies from Heaven was written by Dennis Potter, who
right.
also did The Singing Detective, which
right.
a lot of people in the States. So did you relate to the music in here, to living through the fantasies of pop songs?
Oh, I love the music. Love the music. Music helped me survive a period in my life that was very dark.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working Vegas, and you know, I was doing my act, and I was tired. And in Vegas, you work all night and sleep all day, so essentially, you never see the sun, which, as we found out later, has a debilitating effect on a human being. And it was very low, and I just go to bed at night listening to these songs. I love them. I'm always surprised they never play 30s music on the radio, but they play 40s music and horrible 50s music, but not 30s music.
Let's get back to your new book of plays, mm-hmm. A book called Picasso at the La Panagille. We talked a little bit about the title play.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about what Patter for the Floating Lady is about. There's a magician in this.
Right. There's two plays in there based on magic tricks. One is called The Zigzag Woman, and one is called Patter for the Floating Lady. And I wanted to do some short plays around these big illusions.
Mm-hmm.
And The Zigzag Woman is they're both standard tricks. The Floating Lady and The Zigzag Woman is a zigzag is a put a woman in a box and you remove her middle, essentially. And I use that as a device of a woman trying to give herself a presence in a way, and to also as a metaphor that she's torn apart. And so she has the structure of that play is the three men come in of different ages, a young man, a middle-aged man, and an older man, and they all sort of reflect on their life and their relationships with women. And Patter for the Floating Lady is, it's kind of an ironic title because patter means, you know, magician's dialogue. And it's supposed to be standard patter that some magician could use, but of course they couldn't because it's much too dark and not funny. It's a magician who comes out and he wants to levitate his ex-girlfriend so she will know how it feels to be free, because it's what he could never give her while they were together. And, you know, it's kind of metaphorical, I guess.
She does actually levitate a few inches mm-hmm. off the ground mm-hmm. in this. When the play is performed, do the performers need to know the magic trick?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they're sworn to secrecy. We did it at the Public Theater downtown, and the actors have to sign agreements and everything. And rightly so.
It always amazes me, you know, that the seriousness with which that pledge of secrecy is taken mm-hmm. in the magic mm-hmm. world.
It really is. To this day, I find it almost impossible to reveal a trick to anyone. My mother. You know, it's just something that is you take so seriously when you're 10. And it just kind of stays with you. And magicians, they really don't reveal tricks.
Did you have to sign a pledge when you were 10?
No. But you sort of take the oath from the magic book, you know, privately and seriously.
I'm wondering, in your work as a writer and a performer, what you think the mix is of inhibition and exhibitionism, if you know what I mean? A lot of performers strike me as being a very interesting mix of inhibition and exhibitionism, of really wanting to show off, and of, on the other hand, being really shy and very uncomfortable around other people.
Well, I think that entertaining is the excuse to open up, so I feel myself very shy. I mean, when I started out, very shy around people. But as you get comfortable with your friends, you really open up. And that's where comedy comes from, is, you know, going crazy with your friends and then trying to put it on stage. And I know what you mean. There is a kind of quietness that comes. And then maybe because of that quietness, you're compelled to go on stage and let something out and try to be liked, you know.
Steve Martin, he has a new book of plays called Picasso at the La Panagille. Coming up, comic and actor Robert Wall on his new HBO series Arliss. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
After co-starring in the sports movies Bull Durham and Cobb, Robert Wall is starring as a sports super agent in the HBO comedy series Arliss. The show satirizes the sports world, but as Karen James wrote in the New York Times, it works even better as a shrewd send-up of the culture of money, hype, and celebrity. Wall, who got his start as a stand-up comic, writes for the series and serves as an executive producer. In this scene from the second episode, Arliss is negotiating a contract for a washed-up ball player. Arliss is looking for a $2 million contract, but the owner thinks that's high. Here's the club's contract negotiator.
We prepared a counterproposal. Because we value commitment, team loyalty, our club is prepared to offer your client a one-year contract for $750,000.
$750,000? You're not being serious. Okay. If it's going to help move things along, we will go $1.9 million.
$750,000. It's final, and we need your answer now.
$750,000? Oh, come on. The guy's got to eat. He's got a family. They've got to have clothes. I'll tell you what. How about we go $1.6 million this year, and we do an additional year for $1.4 million? Deal? Win-win?
As a contract, Arliss, you have no leverage. Your guy is a broke-down dog who no one else will touch. Now, you get him to sign a contract, or he can go back to picking cane.
Sometimes there is disagreement over the worth of a client's services. However, it is never, ever personal.
Robert Wall, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, did you meet any sports agents before writing the series?
Yeah, sure. And they've been great. I mean, I met a lot of them. And
did you hang out with them, watch them work?
A little bit. A little bit. They have allowed me to, you know, be in the offices and talk to them, pick their brains. And I have great respect for sports agents. I think much more so than theatrical agents for the most part. I mean, as I said to somebody in an interview, I said, you know, even today, like there's talk here about one of the head of the big agencies, talent agencies, moving to become a head of Sony, his pictures. And I said, that doesn't happen in sports. Theatrical agents all want to be something else. They all want to be a studio executive. They want to be a producer. They want to be something. Sports agents are sports agents. That's what they do. I mean, they're not going to be heads of baseball teams and football teams with very, 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 very. I think I've heard of one guy moving in all the years, moving from an agent to a management position. Excuse me. But that doesn't happen. I mean, so sports agents are, that's what they do.
Now you don't have to name names here, but during the time when you were hanging out with sports agents, maybe watching them work, did you come across anything particularly interesting or absurd that you managed to work into one of the shows?
Let me think offhand. I mean, I'm sure there's been a few things. It's because of the clients, basically, more than anything else. It's just, you mentioned how, about the joke about her throwing up. What I learned early on, I did the movie Ron Shelton, but we did Bull Durham, and we were in a locker room, and it was a locker room scene, and everybody, we just won a game. Everybody's, yeah, cheering. And he said, guys, don't be cheering so much. This is all routine. This happens every day. When you're doing a job, this is your workplace. It's like after you finish this interview, I'm sure, as good as it is, and I'm sure it'll be in your best of series, that afterwards you're not going to go slap hands and give high fives to everybody, you know?
Right.
It's like it's routine.
That was some heck of an interview.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Wow, what a show.
We did it.
Right, but it's routine. So this is the world he lives in, and everything should just be routine. Mm-hmm. So that's what it comes down to.
Now, before doing Arliss, you did a movie called Open Season that was about an error in the Nielsen ratings that makes public television the top-rated network.
Right.
It's a very funny premise, and I could say that for sure, working in public radio. Now, did you come up with any phony shows that were funny for your movie about this public television network?
Oh, absolutely. We had when ratings become number one, we had a Tom Selleck played a man who was a cellist at night and a crime fighter during the day, and his name was Leslie Manahoff, but everybody called him the Rock, so he became Rock Manahoff, a cultural crime fighter. We had a thing called the Impress Track, which is like a laugh track, except that it would tell you it would have Shakespeare on. We had Joe Piscopo playing Hamlet. And he would say, oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. And you'd hear, ooh, ah. You know, again, on your laugh track, the same thing about the laugh track. We had a Greek's Company, which was a sitcom set in ancient Greece, in like a co-ed dorm and doing all the same leering jokes with Alan Thicke. What else did we have there? We had Rachmaninoff. We had Leslie Maninoff. I forget what else. We had a whole bunch of stuff there. But it was fun. It's a very funny movie.
Now, you used to be a stand-up comic.
Yes.
So many stand-up comics have sitcoms now with their name on it. Did you want a sitcom called Wall?
No, I don't think. No. Again, we go back to the old sitcom. Ron Shelton used to say, you know, because they used to ask me to do sitcoms, and he'd say, "Oh, Robert, you should do it. You'd be, you know, you'd make a lot of money, you'd be very famous, and you'd be totally miserable." I said, "Exactly."
Huh.
So, no, this is my first foray into series television. This is the right gig for me. I'm in the right position.
Now, you wrote for Rodney Dangerfield for a while.
It was my first gig. It was my first job.
Wow. Did you write jokes about not getting enough respect?
Oh, sure. I mean, I would meet Rodney, and first time I met him, I remember he was in the dressing room, and I said, I got some jokes for you. He goes, "Okay, kid, let me hear them." And I'd say, "Okay, I'm all right now, but last week I was in rough shape. Guy comes up to me at the airport. He says, loan me $5 till payday." I say, "When's payday?" He says, "I don't know. You got the job." And he goes, "Okay, kid, the jokes are good, but don't do me." You know, so, but what I learned from Rodney a lot was, who is an incredibly underrated comic artist, Rodney Dangerfield. He's one of the most brilliant comic writers. I mean, a one-liner is a very perfect art form. It has a beginning, middle, and an end in a very short period of time, and a payoff. It's a very, very, very hard art form to do. The great thing about stand-up comedy is, unlike any other art form, you get an instantaneous response. I mean, you think of a piece of material, you try it out. If it works, you get a response immediately back from the audience. You don't get, and you can do it that night. You can't do that with a movie, which may take years to get made, and you cut it and do it different ways. You can't do that with a book, which takes, you know, you're not even there when people read it. You can't do that with anything else that's instantaneous. That's a wonderful, wonderful thing to have.
Had you seen his act a lot before writing?
Oh, sure. I was very familiar. I was out of college, and I was very familiar with Rodney Dangerfield.
Mm-hmm. Now, his style is nothing like yours, though. So what did you want to write for him?
Well, it's not a question of my style. I didn't have a style back then. Mm-hmm. And I started out writing, and he's the best. He was the best. You know, I've always prided myself, and my whole... the people I grew up idolizing are people like Lubitsch, Sturgis, Billy Wilder, Kaufman and Hart, Neil Simon, and I think of myself as a collaborator, and... I always wanted to work with the best people, and he was doing the hippest stuff when I mean, he had great jokes. I mean, all the college guys would sit around and watch his jokes. And so it was unquestionably the best comic of that period. So I wanted to write for the best. And so I would meet him, and I wrote jokes for him. And I could also edit jokes for him, which is where I really learned a lot.
How do you edit a joke?
You do a payoff after you do a setup. You do the setup before the payoff. It sounds very simple, but it is amazing how many people don't know how to do that. I mean, that's why you'll say, why it's not working? Well, most jokes don't work because they're not set up properly. Most stories don't work because they're not set up properly. Once you have your setup, everything, your pieces in place, what you need, what you don't need, what you have to reinforce at times before you do the payoff, before you do your third act, it's all structure. You know, so and how you get to that artistically and creatively is where the craft takes place.
My guest is Robert Wall. He's now starring in the HBO series Arliss. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Robert Wall, he stars as a sports super agent in the new HBO comedy series Arliss. He got his start as a stand-up comic. Now, did you think you were a hip comic when you started?
I was hip in a way that was it was smart. It was hip isn't the right. I mean, the term hip, I dropped that out there. It sounds like trendy and happening and like I should have a dance beat behind me or something like that, you know, a real acid rock mix going like I'm on Train Spotting. But that, I mean, what is he talking about? What is he saying? Are you hearing the music? It's all about the music. Neil Simon, who I met one time, who, you know, one of my huge influences, was talking about people who, directors and editors and everybody, who they just don't hear the music. And I know exactly what he's talking about. If you look at your best comics, your best comic artists, invariably they're very much into music. Woody Allen is, you know, look at the use of music in his films, look at how he plays an instrument. Mel Brooks is always talking about music, and Neil Simon and Steve Martin, you know, and these people are all into music. They understand where their rhythms are. And that holds true. I mean, a lot of them come from musical theater, and if they don't, they come from, there is some musical, it's all rhythm, it's all the score.
You know, I always wonder how somebody figures out when they're young that they think they're funny enough to get, you know, paid to do it professionally. It's a fantasy a lot of people have, few are good enough to do it. What made you think you could do this for a living?
I always wanted to be a filmmaker. Growing up, I would read the newspaper and the sports page and the movie theater, movie section, and I always wanted to be a filmmaker or a director and producer of films. And so I was watching everything, and I particularly enjoyed comedies. And I had, I don't know, I would, even in class, I mean, the term, of course, is class clown. I always prefer to think of it as the class wit, pretentiously, she said. And
the class humorist.
Yeah, the class humorist. You never saw that. You see, that? There you go. I mean, that should be. I mean, why is it the class clown? First of all, it puts a connotation that clown is a bad thing. It's not like I pulled up every day, you know, out of the school bus and had 42 little, in a little Volkswagen, 42 of us came out. You know, it's like there should be a class humorist. And then they write this the class humorist would probably be somebody who wrote something droll in the class newspaper, which no one would ever get a laugh out of in a million years. But, I mean, yeah, you know, I made jokes. You know, I did make jokes. I have comebacks. I would do funny stuff. Again, going back to Ron Shelton, who is another one of my mentors, we talk about the most overused phrase, the misused phrase maybe in the English language, a sense of humor. Most people always say they have a sense of humor. Well, that's not really true. They may have an appreciation of humor, but it's not a sense in the sense of taste, feel, touch. They can't touch humor. They can't see something and taste where the humor is coming from. You don't have a sense of drama. Nobody has a sense of, you know, they have a sense of dance, but suddenly everybody's got a sense of humor. Well, that's not true. There's very, very few people who have a sense of humor, can see a situation and suddenly say, you know, I can make something funny out of this. If you do this instead of this, if you come in earlier, if you come in later, delay this, you know, come in there. What if this happens? You know, there's not that many people. Now, a lot of people have an appreciation of the humor once they see it, but they really don't have a sense of it. You know, so that's, I think that I was fortunate enough, you know, in the last, you know, somewhere along to realize that I maybe I did have this sense of it.
You really sound like a humor doctor.
Well, no, there's definitely a science and a craft if you watch it, and a historian.
Right, yeah.
I mean, I watched, you know, the best, and then you make it your own. I mean, in the beginning as a stand-up comic, I emulated Woody Allen. I emulated, it was a lot of Rodney Dangerfield, a lot of Woody Allen in me. Probably a little bit of Robert Klein and George Carlin, because they were, very, you know, those were the two people at that time. I love the storytelling of Myron Cohn, and I was a Jack Benny, a huge freak. My influences are as much Myrna Loy, Carol Lombard, Cary Grant, William Powell. Oh, man, going on. Jack Benny, I mentioned.
Who were the people who were coming up with you when you were getting started in the comedy?
Oh, wow. If you came to we were talking about this the other day. If you came to the improv when I was there, let's see, Joe Piscopo. Jay was just passed. Jay Leno had already panned out of there. But it was Joe Piscopo, Jerry Seinfeld, Paul Reiser, myself. When I was on the road, I was in Denver, and an auditioner was a woman named Roseanne.
Right.
Dennis Miller, Dana Carvey, Robin Williams. It was a pretty good night. You could see a pretty good show there. Larry David, who was the co-creator of Seinfeld. The club owner at the time was Chris Albrecht, who is now the head of HBO. And so it makes things easier for me.
Yeah, that must have been a help to you.
Yeah, well, it was a help because he knows me. I mean, you know, we came up together, and he was the man who put me on the stage and would make out the lineup card, so he knows what I'm capable of doing. Plus, we work in a shorthand. It's always nice to have somebody who... He's probably, and as far as executives go, I've never met anybody who has as much insight, because Chris was a comic and then he became a club owner. So he knows what it's about. So, I mean, he gets an amazing amount of, you know, respect from me, and also he should get some of the success for Arliss, because this is his puppy. And but, I mean, the people in it were, Lane Boozler was there. I mean, some terrific people.
I guess one of the really good things about doing a sitcom on HBO as opposed to doing stand-up is that you don't have hecklers when you're doing a sitcom?
No, and I'm not doing a sitcom. I'm doing a
comedy
series.
Yes, right. Thank you. Right. Okay, good. But anyways, you don't have hecklers.
Oh, yeah, that's a big advantage. Yeah, you don't have hecklers. You don't have drunk women in the front row. You don't have club owners who are ripping you off. You don't have opening acts that go on forever and do your act before you
right.
get to do it. You don't have...
Did that happen? People would steal your act before you...
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, of course. Of course. Sometimes you go up there and somebody just did a routine. The guy said, we just did it. What are you talking about? You don't have the comedy condos that you have to live in on the road. You don't have the hours are totally different. I mean, the hours are actually tougher probably here, although they're not as late. You don't have to travel as much. You don't have to eat the bad food as much. There's big advantages. There's real big advantages.
Well, Robert Wall, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Robert Wall is executive producer, writer, and star of the new HBO series Arliss. The new movie, Grace of My Heart, is an homage to the Brill Building, the New York office building that was home to many of the great pop songwriters of the 60s. Thursday on Fresh Air, we'll hear from the director, Allison Anders, and Friday on our archive show, we'll feature interviews with some of the Brill Building songwriters, Carole King, Ellie Greenwich, and Lieberman Stoller. The songwriter in the new movie has some of the characteristics of Carole King and of Ellie Greenwich. Here's one of Carole King's songs, as recorded by Aretha Franklin. I'm Terry Gross.
So uninspired, and when I knew I had to face another day, Lord, it made me feel so tired. Before the day I met you, life was so unkind, and you're the key to my peace of mind, 'cause you made me.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Crown Publishing Group, publisher of Downsize This, Random Threats from an Unarmed American by Michael Moore, creator of TV Nation and Roger and Me. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Inside the Brain, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Ronald Kutulak tells us about the latest research into how the mind works. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.